next thing. Slightly faster and slightly slower.
Stand still.
Okay. Work in Nepal, they have lots of blacksmiths. It's a caste in the Hindu caste system, a blacksmith, like a tailor or whatever. But because they're doing something that involves turning nature, raw nature, into culture, In the caste system, it's considered the complete bottom of the hierarchy. I wouldn't be able to have a meal with you if you were in India. You'd be an outcast. Blacksmiths are complete outcasts. You're not allowed in my house. I'm not allowed to touch you. If I just touched you like that, I would be polluted. I'd have to go and go through a special ritual.
You probably would now.
You're in a good position in this.
Well, it's a little bit different in this country, where just the opposite. We have to be registered under the Farriers Registration Act of 1975 to be able to call ourselves farriers, shoof again, or even do your own horses. You have to be registered under the Act of Parliament. So it's...
You have a high status. We all try and be farriers in this country. In Nepal and India, you try and avoid it. But in many parts of the world, it's considered to be sort of polluting and dangerous. But it's certainly a very old profession, isn't it?
The blacksmiths go back to about 2000 BC. The Assyrians, I believe, were the first blacksmiths. And the farriers were about 50 BC. Nailing shoes on horses' feet, about 50 BC.
Whereabouts was that?
Northern Hemisphere, probably North France, Great Britain.
That's very interesting. So it wasn't Romans?
No, they used to put metal shoes on, but they tied them on. Hippo sandals.
Did they?
Yeah, not very efficient.
No, very inefficient.
But we had to be more efficient because we wanted to use the animal on the farm for ploughing and pulling. And because the conditions, wet conditions all the time, their feet tended to dry and get wet. And so they weren't as hard as the Arab-type horses in the Mediterranean area. And so they really needed something on their feet to protect them from going footsore all the time. Mm. And so that's why we nail the shoe on now. It's not changed at all in 2,000 years. It's exactly the same.
Good. So if you imagine trying to tie one of those things on, how long would it last?
In a wet, muddy field, it wouldn't stay on for 10 yards, I don't think.
Because, I mean, the Japanese, I was amazed, the Japanese tie straw sandals.
That's right, yeah.
You've heard of this on their shoe. I mean, if you tried straw sandals onto these things, that wouldn't last for long, would it?
Well, they're big, heavy horses. The amount of power that they push through their feet as they're pulling or towing or whatever they're doing, it would just take them straight off, wouldn't it? It needs to be nailed on. Traditionally, it was nailed on with 7 nails. If you see the film, when I put 9 or 10 nails in. Now these horses are working in heavy clay conditions all the time. Every day they're working. And my first priority is to keep the shoe on, so I put extra nail holes in the shoe.
You're probably going against the magical number 7.
7, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Everything's 7. Exactly. We made a shoe earlier, so again,
and blacksmiths are very much associated with magic, as you know.
And saddlers.
Yes.
Yeah, because all their holes on the bridles should number 7.
So you're breaking that by putting extra nails in, but it's a good precaution.
That's why I'm not winning the lottery. The wall of the foot. And that protects it from either drying out too much or absorbing too much moisture. He's producing no periopo at all. And as a result, his feet are spongy because the conditions have been wet over the past 12 months. They're really deteriorating quite quick, so he's a mineral deficiency that he's got. Because we do the other horse and it's fed exactly the same, and the other horse has got a good feed.
Has he?
So
you need to watch it, otherwise you'll have problems.
Yep.
It's getting difficult to actually attach the thing.
That's right. We haven't lost a shoe yet. That's quite, I think that would be the next stage. They're just not, the nails are not going into good solid form.
I mean, supposing there was no problem with the foot actually getting spongy and so on, how much less efficient would it be for a horse to try and pull in heavy, wet soil without a bit of metal, so to speak, attached to its foot?
He would cope all right. I think this horse would probably be all right for a few weeks' work until he goes foot sore, and then it's like wearing your fingernails down.
Mm.
Just too far, somebody that bites the fingernails a bit low and they get a bit sensitive. The horse is standing on his fingernail, and so he becomes sensitive. He needs a few days off and he'd probably be alright then after a couple of days. But if he continually goes foot sore, then he needs shoes to protect him.
Mm. So it's mainly the protection, it's not so much making a better grip on the soil.
No.
What I thought it was.
Shoeing is what we call a necessary evil.
Ah.
It's not good for horses to be shod. The foot isn't a solid mass. It moves in and out. It expands and contracts as it hits the ground and lifts off.
Mm.
And so by putting the shoe on and nailing it on, you're removing some of this expansion and contraction.
Mm.
And by doing that, the horse is prone to foot problems, not because of bad shoeing, but because of continuous shoeing.
Mm.
Side bones, ring bones, ankylosis, those kind of diseases that horses get.
Mm.
They're all associated with navicular disease in particular, not being able to move in and out, expand the foot.
Mm.
So if possible, not to shoe the horse. Mares in pole and ones that are not working are never shod.
Mm. So, isn't it?
It acts as a shock absorber for the foot, and the wedge shape acts as an anti-skid device, really, stops it slipping. Obviously,
and have you shaped it like that? And cut away
no, that's
stuff?
Natural.
That's natural, isn't it?
So that's the frog. Mm. Then we've got the sole,
mm.
which is exactly the same as the wall of the foot, which is what I'm about to cut off, except that the sole gets to a set thickness and exfoliates, flakes off on its own at a set thickness. On this horse, just over a quarter of an inch thick.
Mm.
Underneath there is the bone and the soft tissue.
Mm.
The wall is just like our fingernail, it continually growing.
Mm. So you cut it off on the back.
So, and that's why he needs shoeing as regular, about every 4 to 6 weeks.
So if you had a village with a number of horses, this would be a more or less full-time occupation for someone doing these. How long does it take you to shoe a horse?
Under normal circumstances, about an hour.
About an hour.
But these heavy ones take a good bit longer.
Mm. So you could do 3 or 4 in a day.
Yeah, but you don't tell a taxman that.
No. In principle, one farrier could do 3 or 4 horses
yes.
in a day.
Yeah.
Have you done other metalworking? I mean,
no, I'm just a farrier. Yeah. I don't do any blacksmithing at all.
Mm.
Never have done.
Mm.
And my age, I probably never will do.
Because obviously, out of this technology and the skills of blacksmiths grew a lot of the metal workers' art of Western Europe. As you say, it's a 2,000-year-old process, and a civilization which has people constantly playing with metal like this must have led to a lot of people having skills with iron, which in this civilization which doesn't have blacksmithing, as in China and Japan and so on, they just wouldn't have that skill. Seems well-behaved horse, even if it maybe had bad feet.
I think he's only got 2 options, really.
Kick you or not to kick you.
Too easy. If they go in too easy, then it'll probably come out too easy as well. And the periopal is produced by the periopalic ring, which is at the top of the hairline there. And you can see this is just awful.
Yes, it is bad, isn't it?
But he's on the same diet as the other horse, and the other horse has got perfect feet.
I wonder why the horseshoe, I had never thought about it. The horseshoe is such a magical thing, isn't it? I mean, all of us know that we have to keep the horseshoe the right way up, outside our, we have one in our house and so on. It's full of magic, isn't it?
Yeah. Strange how the Germans hang it the other way up.
They
like the luck to run out so that you can get it, not keep it in.
That's I see. So we have a retentive view of luck, and they have a closed view of luck. Take you to learn how to.
Four years, 2 months, the apprenticeship.
Still a friendship system?
Oh, yeah.
Have you got an apprentice?
No.
So you'll be the last of the line, or that line, anyway.
I've got a daughter that could have done the job, but she's got a bad back, so...
Really? It would be all right for a woman to do farrier work.
Yeah.
There are some women farriers,
or
not?
Yeah.
That's one of the questions I'm going to ask the ploughman. So do you think it was... mainly the wetness of northern France and
necessitated putting something on their feet.
Yeah. So if you had the soil here is also not only wet, but also in southern Europe it's rather light and sandy on the coast of the Mediterranean. Up here it's really rich and thick and deep.
That's right.
So you need probably bigger horses and bigger ploughs to get deep into the soil here. And the Romans had these scratch ploughs without wheels, you know, they just went along the surface and scratched like that. And so they could be pulled by oxen.
Yeah.
And would you shoe an ox?
They did shoe oxen, yes.
They did?
Yeah.
Oh. That was in this country they shoed oxen?
Yeah.
Mm. I didn't know that. And you chew them in exactly the same way as?
No, they're cloven hooves, so they're two half shoes.
Two half shoes, oh, I see. But you'd have to keep shoeing them to protect the cells of it. Anything as complicated in a way as. Well, it's not very. The actual principle is not very complicated, is it? But it's just. Once you've had the idea, it's simple, but they've never seen any shoeing like this in Asia, you know,
no.
At all.
I think the farriers themselves are their own worst enemy because we make the job look very rough and ready.
Mm.
When in actual fact, there is no room for error. Everything has got to be absolutely spot on. If I'm fitting the hind shoe and I was at a quarter of an inch wide on the inside, it would slice the opposite leg wide open. There's no question about
really?
It.
Really? Gosh.
And if it was too long on the front, the hind shoe would come along, hit the front shoe and strike it off. So there is no room for error at all. And if you fit them too tight, you'll stab them because the nail holes have got too far in.
So this is absolute precision engineering, isn't it?
It has to be spot on.
Mm.
It is.
Because one of the things that people often commented about the West was that all their, whatever they did very precisely. They had to get it exactly right. It was no good saying, well, that's getting more or less right.
It won't do.
Yes.
I always say it'll do. It means it's absolutely spot on.
I mean, the Chinese had a saying, it's good enough, which means it's roughly right. But with this, you've got to get it absolutely right. And so this is, in many ways, one of the origins of modern precision engineering in the West. It was a long series of playing with metal but knowing that you can't make errors, otherwise it won't work. So that's very interesting.
But it does look very rough and ready, ripping the shoe off, cutting the foot back. The foot has to be balanced and level, and most people don't notice you're doing that, looking at the level, the angle of the axis, everything to do with the leg itself. They don't notice you're doing that, but you just do it automatically.
But you learnt it as a set of principles. You learnt that you've got to get the angle of the axis exactly right. You learnt this consciously.
Yes.
And then you just internalise it, and it's now just part of how you do it. So like all great craft skills, it becomes just an extension of yourself, and you're just doing it. Well, maybe we can catch that on television, because I would never notice it. Now you've mentioned it, when we watch the film, we will see how you're making all these calculations and getting it absolutely precise. Because some ways what you're demonstrating is that in the West, our civilization is really one which could be defined as a metal, glass, stone civilization, whereas in most of the world, they really don't use metal at all. Or hardly at all. They use bamboo and paper and soft substances.
Yeah.
But here you're really dealing with very, very hard substance, which you have to get absolutely precisely right. You wonder whether this hurts the horse.
Well, if I do too much, it will scald the horse's foot. It will be exactly the same as shoving your hand in boiling water.
Mm.
I suppose the trick is knowing just how far you can burn it in.
Yeah. How much does it weigh?
Well, he won't be a ton, but he'll be close to that. He'll be three quarters of a ton.
Three quarters of a ton. What kind of horse is it?
This is a Shire.
Shire,
yeah.
Is it? The famous.
The one that most people think of when they think of cart horse. But not the only breed, it's the one.
Yeah.
The other horse, the grey horse, that's a Percheron, which originally is a French breed.
Is it? Mm.
But if you put it between them,
I tried to work out there are various estimates of the relative power of a horse like this, and I've got one estimate which said that measuring it by modern horsepower of a car, a human being has between 3 and 5% of a horsepower of a car. If you put about 30 human beings against one horsepower engine, they would just be about the same. And the estimate for a horse itself is something like about 30 to 50 or 60% of a... So that by this estimate, my guess was that one horse was about... If you put a number of people in there and I had a tug of war, it would, from these figures, it looked as if you'd get between 15 and 20 people. A horse could pull about 15 or 20 people. Do you think that's about...
What sort of weight would that be? I was working on the basis of a single horse would pull somewhere around 2.5-3 ton.
Will it? In a cart?
In a cart. Spur of horses, 7-8 ton. There were tests done in the 30s, I think, where I think a single horse pulled about 19.5 tons. But that's unusual. They'd never be expected in normal working conditions.
If you had absolutely flat...
Yeah, once you've got a wheeled vehicle moving, the momentum is taking it along. It's different with something like ploughing, where it's a dead weight all the time. So that, whatever it be, ton and a half, 2 ton, is 2 tons all the time.
Yes. So probably, one horse is worth quite a lot of people in terms of...
Oh, yeah. Pulling power, yeah.
Pulling power.
Yeah.
The other thing that... in the discussions about the comparison between a horse and an ox, it's reckoned that one of the advantages of the horse is that it can work longer hours.
Yeah, to work on that, it tends to be able to work a little bit faster than...
Yes, that's the other thing, that its actual pulling power is not much more than an ox, but it can work faster.
And I think the development of the implements as well has made a difference. If you go back to very early ploughs, they were very...
I'm just doing that so you can see, or...
Yeah, I'm feeling as well as looking, using the thumb there, just to make
sure... Your feeling is absolutely precisely on.
But it's not precisely on, you can see foot sticking out very slightly on that outside branch there. So it wants pulling out from about a second nail.
It's usually fitting, isn't it? Yes. If it overlapped a little bit, then it would...
If you overlap and it just happens, either him or a horse that you've got next to him stands on the edge, and it just bumps in. So it's just crucial, the fitting of
it. Yes, much more crucial. My gumboots are three sizes too big, and it doesn't matter that three sizes too big would
make a difference.
His short shoes would make a difference. I mean, what strikes you as you look around this yard is metal. Metal here, in my hand, on all round, as well as the horseshoes, which obviously are metal, but everything, in order to make the horseshoes, you need lots of metal. And then in order to use the horseshoes, you need lots of metal on the horse itself. And so you begin to see in a tiny capsule here a kind of civilization which had developed this powerful substance from the ground. And when you contrast it with most civilizations, which hadn't got the wood to burn to make the metal, they hadn't got the precision metalworking experts developed over centuries to use this stuff. And so you begin to see the difference. I mean, we're standing here in the Black Country, which is full of blackness and metal, and founded itself on, was the foundation of the Industrial Revolution. And so out of this early medieval use of metal for horses and other purposes, you begin to see how you can get civilization drifting towards a heavy industrial precise use of a fantastic thing that occurs in the soil, metal, as compared to someone like China or Japan or Nepal, where metal is just a luxury which you can just use a little bit of if you need it, but most people can't see any purpose for it at all. So you're getting a metal and glass civilization compared to a bamboo, paper, and earth civilization. And that's one of the great sort of divides in history, as far as I can see. And it started quite recently, because even the Romans didn't really use metal very much. And no civilization before the medieval West became obsessed with the use of this substance. I don't suppose you know, but when Fukuzawa, the Japanese philosopher, went to America and Europe, one of the things that struck him above everything else was the use of metal. He came from a country where basically used bamboo and paper and clay, and everything had to be shaped out of that. And when he saw these piles of metal, rotting metal, metal thrown away in the streets everywhere in America, he told his friends back in Japan, he said, look, you know, when Tokyo burns down, among the embers you find these poor people rushing They have a civilization of warships and guns and metal. We have a civilization of paper and other things. And so one of the great divergences in world history between Asia, which went for natural substances and things that you can get from nature without any extra working, and the West, which applied energy and thought and science to get extracting something from the soil, turning it into something extremely powerful with tools to make a new world. And the Industrial Revolution was the final outcome of that change.
So are you saying it's lack of natural resources or attitude of mind?
It's really an attitude of mind. I mean, there's plenty of iron ore in China and to a certain extent in Japan, but there was no purpose to it. I mean, why do it? You could see no real use for it. For example, horseshoes you didn't need in these countries because you didn't have horses and you didn't plow in that way. So one of the great uses, you didn't have guns. But of course, all these arguments go around in circles. One of the reasons perhaps you didn't have the development of guns, and later of steam engines, was that there had been no earlier metallurgy industry which had developed the skills to do these things. But certainly no one could see any use for metal. You don't build houses with it. So often you need to turn these questions around. Why did the West develop metal when there are other things which they could have used, wood and so on? So that's the puzzle, really, the Western obsession from the Middle Ages, because the Romans didn't have this obsession, nor did the Greeks. From the Middle Ages on, the West, particularly Northwest Europe, became obsessed with metal. Not because they had plenty of it around, but because it was an attitude of mind and an organization which encouraged it.
Because obviously metal is incredibly useful for making tools and pots and pans and all the everyday essentials of life. Surely those essentials are important to China and Japan as well.
No, they're not. I mean, if you take pots and pans, who needs pots and pans when you have wonderful china and clay in Japan? Or you can make bamboo is one of the most versatile tools. You can make almost anything from bamboo. There are thousands of uses of bamboo. So a civilization that has bamboo more or less replaces metal. So that if we had had bamboo in England on a wide scale, we might never have had a metal industry.
So wax came later?
Wax. It's useful for wax, but there are plenty of other ways of getting things without a wax.
So, I mean, surely for agricultural implements, metal, surely they could see that that had some use.
Well, for just the tips and the ends and whatever of hoes and plows, it is a much better technique. So there was, I mean, I'm not saying there wasn't any metallurgy. It was on a much reduced scale. It was only used in specialised. What is odd, for example, is that in China and Japan, you don't find village blacksmiths. There's no such a thing as a village blacksmith, whereas in France or England or Germany, one of the most important people in every village was a blacksmith, and there might be several. So you had a full-time person working with metal in every village, whereas in these other countries, there were no village blacksmiths, there was no need for them. To make tools, or any of the metal things, it requires an enormous amount of thought and energy. And it's not perhaps a coincidence that the great economist Adam Smith, when he was trying to illustrate the central essence of what had made the modern world, which was the division of labour, he used as his most famous example, which every school child should learn, the making of nails. He'd observed as a boy living up on the Scottish coast how in nail-making factories, if one person sits down and tries to make a nail, it'll say take them 5 minutes to make the nail. They have to make the head and then they have to craft down and so on. It's quite a difficult business. So it'll take them 5 minutes. If you get a group of people sitting at a bench and the first one hits the top of the nail and he passes it on to the next person who hits the next bit of the nail, and you work down the nail like that. In other words, if you have a division of labour and you divide it, you work out exactly what needs to be done. You have a conveyor belt, as with modern factories, making nails. The magical result of this is that one person in an hour can make 60 nails, but 10 people can not just make 600 nails, 10 times as much, they can make 6,000 nails, say. They can, in other words, they can, by dividing the task up into little bits, you're thinking about it, you can increase productivity enormously, so that the professionalisation and division of labour and the development of modern economies is largely because we had to make tools and to make things and to think about making them. You can't divide pottery up very easily, you can't divide working with bamboo up, but working with metals, you're constantly thinking, ah, I could improve that by doing that and so on. So the tool making and the development of metals is one of the essential features of the, another essential feature, as Adam Smith thought, of the Industrial Revolution. There was on it.
Oh yes, yes. Yes.
In the old days, in the Roman times, they used to just, with oxen, you just tied rope around here, and then tied plough, the rope at the back. So you just tied a piece of rope around there and tried to plough with that. What would happen?
I mean, in theory, it would work. I mean, you're basically looking for something to pull by. So they're taking the weight of the pull.
Mm.
So in theory, either those or a rope you could put around. The collar really is just cushion.
Mm.
It's protection, and that's exactly. Mm. If you plough, if you took him out just with that,
yeah,
or just with a rope,
mm,
his shoulders get sore.
Yes.
So you can obviously plough a lot longer.
Yes.
With a cushion, and that's all it is. It's only protection. Can you tell me that?
Because the other theory, I mean, the harness was meant to be a great sort of world revolutionary breakthrough, because it would also, the cushioning would distribute the pull, and particularly make it come down here with the rope. The theory was that it would throttle, strangle it, it would just pull there. And but the main pull comes down at this angle like that, and so it gets the strength of the horse not too high up like that.
That's right. That's effectively that. The line of draft.
Yes.
The line of draft. You can plough it down, you change the cut of that.
Mm.
So to pull from that point,
mm,
is going to be the most efficient.
Yeah. And this harness is, in fact, I mean, the Romans didn't, strangely enough, have any kind of harness. I suppose they didn't have horses. The Chinese had a harness, but they hardly used it. And this harnessing of the horse was really one of the great, sort of, meant to be one of the medieval breakthroughs. Cumbersome, large piece of equipment.
Oh, yeah,
it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is essential, obviously. That is basically just a kind of chain. So it's not absolutely necessary to wear the rest. You've obviously got to have a collar, and you've got to have a bridle, and you've got to find that. But that is, it's an addition, really. Occasionally you feel working without that.
Mm.
That basically holds the chain.
Mm.
The crupper, which goes underneath his tail,
yes,
actually, when he puts his head down, it holds the collar in position. So
it's a strange one because although traditionally the blinkers were used, and the idea being that it would stop him being distracted or frightened from anything at the back or the side, it doesn't make him walk in a straight line. I wish it did. But there was a theory that you didn't need blinkers, and certainly some of the companies, particularly railway companies, tended not to use blinkers. There's the other theory, the other side of the theory, is the more a horse can see, the more relaxed he can be. So, but certainly traditionally, blinkers, just to restrict the vision basically, because of course they can see quite a bit more than we can, because eyes at the side of the head as opposed to the front, his vision comes back and is accurate.
I never noticed a horse's eyes go.
Oh, that's right, yeah. I mean, they can't quite see 360 degrees, but they can see fairly close to that. I mean, not me standing.
There's another package there. Double A's.
The double A's.
Yeah, because he have metal on his height. Not only is this horse an animal with its animal strength converting hay into pulling power, but he's a kind of knight in armour. He's got metal here, metal here, metal here, metal through his mouth, blinkered, a huge piece of metal here distributing the weight so it comes exactly the right traction angle, as you said. Then chains. If anyone was a slave in chains, this poor creature is. Human beings in chaining this power, these animals, for 500 years, 1,000 years, have built up their modern civilization on not human slavery, but animal slavery. The arguments about horses means that one revolutionary effect they had was that they made cities and towns possible, because if you're taking oxen to work, you can only go a very short distance. Oxen move very slowly. You can only basically go about half a mile with an ox before you start working it. Whereas a horse moves quite quickly and can move long distances. So you could begin to have people living in towns, working in the countryside, or living quite far from their farms. And if you, would it be possible to just take this horse for 2 or 3 miles to work in the morning before you start your town?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's not usual to take them that far, because they'd normally be stable near the place of work, but I mean, you walk 3 miles and not be taking long.
Yes, it wouldn't take him very long either. So we're now going to, and with the plough, it's presumably too heavy for you to carry.
The plough is too heavy for me to carry.
Because again, if you were an ox plough using a light, a scratch plough as in the Himalayas, I mean, I see them setting up the plough and then putting it over their shoulder, walking along with the ox.
You won't see me doing that.
I won't see you do it. Well, I see you talking to them.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Because they have a special language to talk to oxen.
Oh, right, yes.
You have a special language, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, and the more you can make a horse understand what you want from your voice, as opposed to pulling on reins, the better for yourself, because you've got less pulling about to do, and the better for the horse, because he's not going to be pulled about. But yeah, the more you can use your voice, the better.
But when you said less pulling about you have to do, how much physical energy does ploughing involve? Because there's a big thesis that basically the Western civilizations, which had horse ploughing, needed men to do the ploughing because it's such a physically demanding work. Whereas women can hoe, so that in other parts of the world where they hoe, the women have a high status. Whereas in the West, where it's men ploughing, they get the high status. But there are other people who say that it would be perfectly possible for a woman to plough.
Yeah, it isn't physical strength, it's technique. If you took over the plough, you would be in a man or a woman, you would find it difficult because you get quite know how to handle it. It's literally the technique, handling the plough. The horses, you make sure that the horses are doing the hard part, running round, the moving of the plough around, and you'll see when we go out there. Although it's physically demanding, it's not so physically demanding that a woman couldn't do it. Certainly today there are women with plough. I think it's much a tradition. It's with men, certain jobs for men, certain jobs for women.
Yes.
Certainly with the horse job. Cooper!
tour the forecast. Oh,